My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
You're listening to The Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello and welcome to this week's Tillage Podcast. I'm Siobhan Walsh. I'm joined as ever by Tillage editor Andy Doyle. And it's a great week to be a tillage farmer. We're recording on Wednesday afternoon this week, and the harvest is well underway, and the majority is probably going to be wrapped up by the weekend. You know, apart from, I know there's farmers up in the north and northwest have plenty of crops to cut still. Look, we'll get the harvest roundup in just a minute, but just to let you know what's coming up on the show, we spoke to Ted Massey from the Department of Agriculture on the new nitrates rules and the stubble cultivation rules. So we'll have that interview for you later on. We'll also have grain market reports, the weather report, and we'll give a preview of this week's paper, which is jam-packed with tillage coverage. Andy, harvest, super yield, super weather, but look, it's a bit of a race now to get dry crops cut.
Indeed it is, Siobhan, and it's a difficult challenge for individuals depending on where you are. Spoke to a man today and he said that he's moving well through his wheat harvest, but progress is extremely slow because straw is not ripe. And to prevent too much going out the back, you have to travel slower to get the throughput low in the machine. So that's a bit disheartening. But then in 2 days' time, that might be after a kind of clearing. The straw could be a lot drier and maybe we can drive on again. But yields are good across the board, thank God. Of course, as always, there'll be an odd one that is either disappointing or is on less good land or whatever. But on winter wheat, it's a year when I'm not hearing very much mention of yields that begin with three. You know, three anything, even 3.9. They're there, of course, they're there. And there'll be more of them to be cut. But it's just going to be one of those exceptional years, which I think farmers had expected and anticipated based on the appearance of crops all the way through. Hard to know where average yields are going to be, but they'll probably knock on the door of maybe 4.4, maybe even 4.5 an acre. I know of some farmers that are already finished their winter wheat and they've finished with yields, average yields above 5. I heard of one man yesterday who cut a block of land after beans, and the block, I don't know what acreage was in it exactly, but it was a farm basically, and it averaged just over 6 after beans. So, you know, you have all of these big yields there. Of course, they don't compensate for treble the acreage that had a lower yield, but there's no indication that there are very low yields out there yet, or to any great degree anyway. And then on the spring barley side, the story is rather similar. You know, very few reports of yields that are less or certainly much less than 3 tonne an acre. a good few reports of mid trees and a few above four as well. All of them helping to kind of prop up good farm averages, because at the end of the day, there's no point in talking about the field that had the big yield. It's your total tonnage divided by your total acreage, your average yield. That's what you have to sell. That's what you make your money on.
Yeah.
And then the flip side, not the flip side, but the other element of it is that quality is between good and excellent. You know, there's almost nothing that's causing problems out there in terms of good grain quality for the feed market anyway. And that's a great story to be able to tell, because the early part of the harvest was very disappointing in that regard with winter barley.
Yeah, like bushels in high 70s for winter wheat and high 60s and over 70 and up to 73 even I'm hearing on spring barley. So really good quality, which is great to hear. But like moisture is an issue, and like, you know, farmers are literally racing against the clock as crops disappear. Like, and you know, we spoke about moisture bonuses in this podcast before, and you know, no real reward there for those low moisture levels, Andy. So farmers are under pressure to get crops cut despite the good weather.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of pressure to move through crops, because that farmer that I mentioned with slow progress, his moisture at that point, and that was this morning, Wednesday, was 17%. So it's not inconceivable that he'd be looking at sub 15s in there tomorrow if it wasn't cut. And that's fact of life stuff. And you know, the same thing is happening on oilseed rape. We've heard of some moisture's on delivered rape being down to 6%. Now, they're the exception, I grant you. But quickly enough, once it starts to dry out, it will drop below 9. And that's the point at which weight loss is not compensated for by any element of moisture bonus. So, you know, there is pressure to get crops saved because of where the moisture levels are. And on specific weights, Siobhan, you mentioned, you know, the highs I actually heard of 82 and plus on grain off the combine for winter wheat.
Yeah.
You know, which is absolutely excellent. Yes.
And as you mentioned, oilseed rape, their yields are still kind of staying around the same as we've reported in previous weeks. They're 1.92 tonne, 2.2 and an odd one higher than that. On malt and barley quality, you know, a lot of low proteins out there, a lot of nines kind of down under the 9.5, an odd few tens. I think distilling barley is quite hard to come by in some places, but not in others. And look, we have a story in the paper this week, and we had it online earlier in the week as well. Bort Malt have brought in, as far as we understand, they're bringing in a drying and energy charge of €12.50. The moisture bonus has moved to €3 per tonne, but basically if you're delivering at 14% moisture, or at, let's say the 12, you still have to pay the €12.50. So you could be delivering barley, but that €12.50 charge is still there, so you won't get all of your moisture bonus that you've been used to getting in recent years. So the goalposts change and mid-harvest, same old story, I suppose. But look, you can read about that in this week's paper. Any other comments to make on harvest, Andy? As you know, you were talking to a lot of people this week, I know, on it.
Yes, Siobhan, like, it's interesting still the fact that there is such a variation in progress in different parts of the country.
Yeah.
Like parts of Kildare, probably parts of North Wexford, even into parts of the Northeast and parts of Cork, probably going to be near enough finished their cereal harvest this week, by the end of the week. And they're a long ways on that road already as we speak. Where other areas, parts on the west and parts of the Midlands, up the Northwest, you know, they're barely starting spring barley now, a bit more progress on winter wheat, granted. So I think we must always remember that. Now, I know that there's a difference in the total volume of grain that's in the different parts of the country. There'd be less total grain there, but it's still extremely important to all the growers who are over that part of the world. So hopefully they can manage to get a lot of progress on that grain to be harvested before we see a break in the weather, which seems likely to happen around the weekend, at least for parts of the country.
Yeah, and plenty of straw being chopped as well. You know, there's a lack of demand there, definitely in the straw market. But tillage farmers are acting appropriately there, and they're turning on the chopper, which is good to see, because, you know, if the demand is in there, there's plenty of P and K in that straw. There's plenty of carbon and other good things to feed the worms. So
yeah, yes, know, indeed, but, Siobhan. And look, you know, I can kind of pull on that hop and ball. I've talked to people in the, across the north to the south of the country during the week, and they all kind of say that, you know, depending, all regular customers are there and they're going to look after them, but not a big amount of demand even for barley straw that's not part of a regular trade pattern for people, but they will all say that there's a lesser demand for wheat and straw, and that's behind why more and more people are making the decision to chop and try and keep to keep the nutrients in the feed, but also to put more goodness back into the land. And it's ironic, I think the numbers that we used a few weeks ago would be the P and K value of taking straw off was about €130 a hectare off of a winter wheat field, if I remember correctly. So like, that's not insignificant in terms of the cost. Now, I'm not one bit convinced that you won't need to apply that P&K next year just because you chopped the straw this year, because it seems to take a long time for soil levels to build where straw is being incorporated, even where you're putting back, putting on the required amount of P&K for straw removal. It does take a while for it to build, but it's money in the bank if you're investing in it in the short term, because sooner or later, it's all going to come on stream for you. The other one, Siobhan, that's just worth a mention in passing, and that is that when we're selling straw, you know, we talk about sequestering carbon, but straw is about 40% carbon. So when you move straw off the land, 40% of that tonnage is carbon. And, you know, we never think about things like that, but we then wonder why our soils continue to lower in terms of soil carbon levels.
Yeah.
And that's because we're mining it and not replacing it. So putting it back in just for the carbon, even long before we get to the stage of getting the possibility of payment for it, it's still good practice. It makes your land better in the longer term.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think, look, this is the time of year as well where tillage farmers, a lot of them are ringing their merchants for fertilizer prices. And as they ring up, they're shocked by those prices. And, you know, I heard a price this week for sulfur can plus sulfur at $7.90 a ton. So people are well aware of those costs and they're ready and willing to put that good back into the ground with their straw.
And I know, Siobhan, an article in the machinery section this week, there's one there on straw chopping, and one contractor that was contacted just talked about how quickly putting straw back into the ground made a difference to how his land behaved. And he acknowledged kind of all the benefits of easier to manage, less time and required, less diesel required, which is to me the big one in the long term. Because if we require less diesel, we use less carbon. Therefore, we have fewer emissions in the tillage sector. Now, I know we're not at the point of being rewarded for that yet. But nowadays, with more expensive prices, it's money that stays in your pocket if you don't have to spend it to buy diesel to get the job done.
No, definitely plenty of pluses there, and farmers definitely taking the action. Look, we might move on just to preview this week's paper. As you said, Peter Thomas Keaveney in the machinery section has a lovely feature on straw chopping and talking to different farmers on their experience with straw chopping and how to incorporate that straw. We have the Bortmod story as well, obviously an update on harvest, and on the tillage pages, we have part two on that grassweed story from VJ in Chagas. And on the tramlines, look, there's plenty of updates from farmers this week in tramlines. James English in Tipperary, Stuart Fitzgerald in Wicklow, and Shane Nolan in Clare, all cutting crops this week. So loads of info there. And of course, we have info on the nitrates regulations and the new nitrates regulations. So earlier this afternoon, Andy and myself had a chat with Ted Massey, and Ted is a senior inspector at the Department of Agriculture with responsibility for the nitrates and biodiversity. Here's how we got on with Ted. Hi, Ted. Thanks very much for joining us. You're very welcome to the podcast. The new nitrates rules have been a really big topic of conversation on the show, and it's really good to have you on to clarify the rules. And look, Ted, I know you're not long in this role either. I think you started in January, so you inherited the nitrates rules, I suppose, from last year. I think most farmers will agree that it's important to look after water quality, and tillage farmers are generally very proactive on this, on, you know, planting cover crops, cultivating stubbles for nitrates and grass weeds. And they were probably very frustrated when the rules came out, forcing, you know, very difficult timelines on them with regard to stubble cultivation. But I just, for the sake of our listeners, we might just recap on those updated rules to the nitrates, because they have been updated with that planned amendment. So shallow cultivation now is only required in Carlow, Cork, Dublin, Kildare, Kilkenny, Laois, Louth, Meath, Offaly, Tipperary, Waterford, Westmeath, Wexford and Wicklow. Where shallow cultivation is required, 20 to 25% of cereal land must not be cultivated. You still have to cultivate within 14 days of harvest, but there is a 10-day leeway there after baling or chopping. Soil consolidation is to be carried out where fields are left uncultivated for grass weeds. That's some of the bromes and the black grass. There's no need to cultivate on an organic farm after root crops or late harvested crops, and where a winter cereal crop, oilseed rape or beans, is due to be planted before the 31st of October, and as well just on the buffer, the buffer required for late harvested crops is a 6-metre buffer. So look, we might get into it. Andy, I know you've a few questions to start off.
Yeah, look, I think, Ted, if I can just ask you to explain what is the basis behind this? What problem ultimately are these regulations intending to solve or attempting to solve?
Okay, yeah, certainly, Andy, and thanks very much for the introduction, Siobhan, as well. Ultimately, we're talking about regulations here that are aiming to reduce the loss of nutrients from agriculture to water. So in Ireland's case, we have a whole territory approach to our Nitrates Action Programme. It's a 4-year programme. So the programme was published in March of this year and runs until the end of 2025. And it includes this shallow cultivation measure, which aims to establish a green cover post-harvest on arable land. And the idea of establishing that green cover, as you guys know, is to absorb nitrogen that would otherwise be lost from the soil. And I suppose the background to that is, in certain areas of the country in particular, we have too much nitrogen leaking from our agricultural systems into our watercourses. And that's creating problems from an environmental perspective. So it's for every sector within the farming community to look to see how they can reduce their impact and ultimately reduce their losses. So what we've done in this measure is we've targeted it to the counties with catchments where the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, have identified a need for nitrogen reducing measures as a priority to address water quality and where tillage is present at a higher proportion of the overall land use. And we can see the impact that tillage can have in terms of nutrient losses through Teagasc's Ag Catchments Programme. And if we look in particular at the Castle Dockrell catchment in Wexford, we can see the losses that are coming from tillage land, in particular in the back end of the year and over the winter.
Ted, when you mentioned there about the proportion, is that the basis for some counties now being excluded?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, we're conscious that there are other counties where there is a need for nitrogen reduction measures as a priority, but there's very little tillage in those areas, or certainly in the areas where we need nitrates reducing measures. So, you know, we were trying to strike the right balance here in terms of water quality and minimizing the impact on biodiversity. So it was felt, you know, in those areas where we have a predominantly grass-based landscape, our farmland birds that rely on overwinter stubble are all the more dependent on those smaller areas of stubble. So those bird species would be more vulnerable if we were to interfere with those small areas. And, you know, ultimately, it's the department's stated position that we want to stabilize and then maintain and expand our area under arable production. So we recognize as well, in some counties, it is harder to grow cereal crops in particular. And you know, the harvest can run late as well. So we were conscious of all those measures. In addition, the soil type as well was also a consideration as we were working on this amendment.
And Ted, as we're looking at the rules and the percentages, When we mention stubble, is it cereal stubble only, or are we also talking about rape stubble, bean stubble?
When we're talking about percentages being left for the birds, we are talking about cereal land only.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you're cultivating, you have to cultivate your oilseed rape stubble or your your beans double, let's say, if they're going to be left over the winter. But cereal land, you want it, it's the cereal land that's needed for the birds, as the habitat for the birds.
Yeah, and look, I appreciate that there are birds that will feed on oilseed rape stubble, that will feed on the likes of bean stubble as well. But I would suggest, you know, a lot of that land is going to go back into winter cereals anyway. Yeah. You know, it's very unlikely that'll be left idle for the winter.
Okay. And in doing that then, because that interferes with calculations, in terms of calculating the 20%, is that calculation purely done on the total cereal area on a farm, or will it include the other combinable crops as well? So if I have 150 hectares of total ground, 20 of which are either oilseed rape or beans, and I would be heading for spring crops on the cereals, how much land do I leave uncultivated, assuming that I have no catch crops or anything like that? So I have 130 hectares. Is it 20% to 25% of the 130, or 20 to 25% of the 150?
It's of the cereal area. So the area under oilseed rape or beans can be disregarded. So
completely in all calculations. Completely,
yes.
Okay.
So
okay.
You're just looking at the cereal area, wheat, oats, barley, and then the other minor cereal crops.
Okay, that clears up something for us, because we would equally call a rape stubble a stubble and a bean stubble a stubble. So that clears that up for people.
Will we run through a few examples just of, I suppose we've had a lot of queries in, Ted, from farmers. So we might just to clear a few things up for people. So let's say a farmer has all winter crops. So they grow winter wheat, winter barley, winter oats, or winter oilseed rape. We'll take winter oilseed rape out of it. So they have winter cereals. Do they need to leave 20 to 25% of their land for overwinter stubble for the birds? So that would be changing their system, that they would have spring crops next year.
No, they can continue to sow winter cereals on all of their land if they wish. What we're saying to that farmer is that in terms of shallow cultivation itself, and where shallow cultivation alone is taking place, there would be an obligation on them to leave the proportion of the stubble sown cultivated to leave space for birds. But if they want to go in and sow a crop, be it a catch crop or a winter cereal crop, that is fine, and they can continue to do that as normal.
So then let's say a farmer who grows 50% winter crops, they've 30% of their land then is in the strong corporation measure. The remaining 20% is in lost catch crops. Are they okay? They don't have to do any stubble cultivation apart from what's required under the strong corporation measure.
Yeah, so in this case, this farmer has 50% of their land in winter cereals. So if that 50% of the land is going to be sown to winter cereals by the 31st of October, that land does not need to be shallow cultivated. Okay, there's no obligation on that land. So that's out. Then you have a separate, I assume, one third of the land, 30% of the land that is subject to SIM.
Yeah.
So that land will need a cultivation. Now, the cultivation that's required for the strong corporation measure, I would say, is a deeper cultivation than the minimum that's required under the nitrates regulations. Because the farmer has to incorporate the straw down into the soil. So you're looking at a heavier cultivation than the minimum that's required for nitrates.
But that would still be minimal, Ted. We would still always try to keep the cultivator up. So in a sense, in my opinion, we're still talking about the same machine and the same job. Because we're not trying to bury the straw, we're only trying to mix soil with straw to begin the process of degradation.
Yeah, and look, for most farmers, they'll have one machine that'll be doing all this work, no matter what it is. In that case, the work for the strong corporation measure will count for nitrates, okay? So that land is taken care of. Then there is another 20%, the remaining 20% on this farmer's holding that is subject to GLAS measures around the establishment of catch crops.
Yeah.
So again, there's a crop being sown there. You know, the catch crop is a crop, a seed will be sown. So that is fine as well. You know, and as part of that process, they may do a shallow cultivation to assist establishment of that catch crop, but that is fine. So in this case, through the farmers' planned cropping schedule for winter cereals, for catch crops under GLAS, and through their obligations under SIM, they have nothing different to do in the nitrates regulations. There's no new requirement for that farmer.
Yeah, no, that's fairly clear. And let's say, Ted, that 20% of land area was going into catch crops, but they weren't under the GLAS scheme. They were for fodder, or they were just the farmer was planting the catch crop over winter. They're still allowed to go ahead and plant that 20%.
Yeah, certainly, you know, no problem. Once you're planting a seed, you're sowing a crop.
Yeah, okay. And look, that's fairly clear. On the 31st of October, so a lot of farmers will plant their wheat into their winter wheat into November in particular. And you know, if weather, I suppose, is an issue, there could be issues on that 31st of October deadline. But look, good practice would be sown for grass weeds and for disease issues. Good practice would be to plant winter wheat in November in some cases. So those farmers then must cultivate stubbles if they're planning on sowing winter wheat into November or winter oats.
Well, those farmers have two options, and it's to look at this space for birds requirement. So, you know, within their cereal area, a minimum of 20% and a maximum of 25% of the cereal land shall not be subject to shallow cultivation. So if the farmer has land that they perceive, you know, there's a risk maybe that they mightn't get it sown by the end of October, or that they're maybe afraid, you know, given the equipment that they have on farm, if that land gets wet in the back end of the year and the soil has been disturbed, that they're afraid of trafficability problems, maybe challenges around getting in to get that seed sown in November. You know, that land can form part of that minimum of a fifth to one quarter of the land that's set aside for the birds, okay? And they can still go in and plow it in November if they wish. The land that they're hoping to sow in October doesn't have to be subject to shallow cultivation anyway. Mm. Now, I would say, you know, it's good practice. And it obviously depends on when that land is going to be sown in October. But, you know, you could see a lot of growth and uptake of nitrates from the soil where shallow cultivation takes place, you know, after, say, winter cereals and maybe between then and mid-October when the land might be ploughed or tilled again, you know.
So effectively, if they're planting in November, the 31st of October is the cutoff, really. So if they're planting in November, that 20 to 25% of land will come out of the winter and spring cereal area.
Yeah, it gives them a little bit of flexibility, you know, if they're running into November and the land they don't want to do shallow cultivation on. But at the same time, the farmer who's going to sow winter cereals, you know, needs to be conscious that there is a weather risk. You know, there'll be some years when, as you both know, when farmers will struggle to get crops sown in that late October, November period in particular. So farmers need to be very conscious and plan now for what they're proposing to do. You know, if an inspector from the department goes out in December, it wouldn't be acceptable for a farmer to say, I left 50% of my cereal area uncultivated because I was hoping to get it sown in late October and sure it rained and what could I do, you know?
Okay, yeah.
Ted, as you rightly say, you know, stubble cultivation is good farming practice. And I'm not aware of too many farmers that are in any way against it. And the major reason for all of the, I'm going to say agro, was just because of the timelines, given the pressure time of the year. But I think a lot of people out there today, particularly anybody that's dealing with problematic grass weeds, know full well that it's one of the major tools that they have, and they would want to be doing it as a measure to try and control other problems, as well as inadvertently, therefore, sucking up a bit of nitrogen in the process. On the 31st of October date, Ted, I'm reckoning that that's kind of twofold. One is that the winter crop that you would plant after that would actually in itself take up relatively little nitrogen from the ground, because it doesn't make a lot of back-end growth. And a lot of the growth happens before that date, and therefore it's the regenerative stuff that would do the bulk of the uptake.
Yeah, and obviously, like, the longer the green cover is there, the more nitrogen it's going to take up. So, you know, in considering the amendment, we were conscious that, you know, the likes of oilseed rape will be sown in say late August, early September on a lot of farms. Your winter wheat, your winter barley obviously will be later. But the longer the green cover has time to establish, the better the return is going to be on that shallow cultivation.
Mm. Yeah. And Ted, maybe you can't answer this one, but it's a direct follow-on, and it's kind of leading to the inevitable question that people ask. If today, if I cut stubble 10 days ago and my cultivation limit was 30, would I do it? Should I do it? I would say to a guy, he shouldn't do it today, because all he'll do is burn metal and send dust up in the sky, which is phosphate blowing all over the place. But he should do it as soon as it's practical to do it, which is after the first shower of rain. Now, you can comment and say that that's not within the law, and perhaps you need to say that.
Yeah, and look, I suppose in trying to develop legislation, you know, and farmers know this better than anyone. There's an objective of trying to keep things simple. And, you know, I saw one person on social media who was making the point that there are a lot of ifs in this measure now, you know, and it's a lot more complicated than it was when we said everything had to be done. That was it. So I suppose if we start getting into saying if the sun is shining or if the wind is blowing, you know, or if the soil is drier than a certain point, it shouldn't be done. But look, the key thing is there's flexibility there now for farmers. For farmers with land that's destined for winter cereals, they have the option to decide will they shallow cultivate or not. You know, there's no obligation to do it if that land is going to be sown by the 31st of October. So that gives them flexibility, and they can decide to wait till they get that shower rain if they wish. You know, in other cases, there will be an obligation for it to be done. But, you know, in amending the regulation, we move from the situation where it was to be done within 10 days of the baling, or 7 days of the baling or the chopping of the straw, to allow it to be within 10 days of that period. And that was also to give people time to get straw cleared off fields as well.
Yeah, but Ted, because we have to understand the difficulty in terms of making the regulations as well. So we do understand that. But as long as there's a little bit of understanding of the fact that a guy on the ground will still be doing his best, but maybe there's a day when he shouldn't. Like if it's too wet within those 10 days, you know, there's no way in hell he should be going out there, but it's probably germinated its own right in that kind of weather. Whereas if you cultivate it today, you're not going to get any germination until it rains anyway. You know, we're not going to get. So if the scope within the regulations for guys to be a bit sensible, but yet to know that they have to comply, and know that the sooner it's done, the better for everybody. It's done in their book, and it's growing vegetation, and that's what we wanted to do. Can I just ask a quick follow-up on the question that Siobhan had? And it's a much simpler question, Ted. If for the guys with, say, 100% spring barley or 100% spring cereal, whatever that cereal is, if they have 50% catch crop, the 20% uncultivated area then applies to the 50% of the area. Am I right in that? So if you had 200 hectares of spring cereal, sowing 100 hectares of catch crop, the 20% applies to the 100 hectares remaining. So he'll cultivate 80 and leave 20. Or cultivate 75 and leave 25. Am I reading that right, Ted?
So in this case, this farmer has 200 hectares in total.
Yeah, it's all spring crops.
So it's 20 to 25% of the cereal land on the holding shall not be subject to shallow cultivation, okay? So it's 20 to 25% of that 200 hectares, if that's all in spring cereals, say, okay, is to be left for the birds. They can still go and they can sow their catch crops on the 100 hectares, and they then do their shallow cultivation on the balance up to that 20 to 25% of the total cereal area. Does that make sense?
Yes. So if I'm reading it right then, Ted, just say it was 100% spring barley with 200 hectares. He's going to put catch crops in 100 hectares and the remaining 100 hectares, the sum is done not on the 100, but on the 200 to begin with. So of the remaining 100 hectares, he would cultivate 50 and leave 50 idle, which would be 25% of his tillage, or of his cereal area.
Yeah, that's correct. And I suppose a simple way for people to think about that rule is look at what you applied for BPS. You know, if you've put down cereal crops for BPS back in April or May, that's the total area we're looking at to calculate the percentage required.
So in the same example, if the guy was actually to go ahead and put in 150 hectares of catch crop, he'd have no cultivation to do.
Yeah, obviously he's cultivating to sow the catch crop, and like
yes.
That's the best scenario, because he's improving his soil, he's capturing nutrients through the catch crop as well, and possibly even providing feed for a livestock farmer, you know?
Yeah. Ted, thanks for those answers.
So Ted, ultimately, like, this, the amendment to the nitrate rules is to provide feed for the birds, and are you happy that this is doing so now? And I suppose I know you have research there ongoing at the minute, and you're engaging with Birdwatch Ireland.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, in introducing any regulation, we have to be conscious of the potential consequences. So with this measure, we wanted to ensure there were no unintended consequences for farmland birds. And we are aware that, you know, various species of farmland bird populations are under pressure in recent years. So I suppose we are trying to strike the balance between leaving space for birds and avoiding a situation where we were going to be restrictive to farmers. So in setting this minimum 20 to 25% of cereal land to be left for the birds, not subject to shallow cultivation post-harvest, our objective is that, you know, there'll be enough overwinter stubble in the landscape as a whole across farms to support those farmland birds that rely on it through the winter. If a farmer wants to go ahead and sow winter cereals as they always have done, they can still continue to do that, because ultimately that's not creating any change from the situation that pertained last year for the birds. You mentioned there, Siobhan, the research that we're doing. Mm-hmm. As part of the work to develop this amendment, we engaged with Chagask and also our colleagues in the National Parks and Wildlife Service. Okay. And we're in the process of developing a long-term research project, because, you know, when you look at the likes of bird populations, it's the population trend over time is what matters. So, you know, we're going to look at farmland birds over a number of years, and we're also going to look at the effect that different methods of shallow cultivation / green cover establishment have on those bird populations. So Chagas are currently working with a number of farmers around the country just to identify sites for the autumn in that regard.
Okay, I know, like, Birdwatch Ireland came out fairly strongly after this amendment came, and they're still very unhappy. Like, are we satisfied that we're not doing damage in the meantime? You know, we've seen the cereal area decline, and thankfully now seen an increase, but there has been a dramatic decline in some of those farmland birds that depend on cereals. So, you know, is it right that the research is coming after the policy, Ted?
I suppose in the ideal world, we would do all the research and have certainty around everything before we do anything. But in that scenario, I'd argue you mightn't get out of bed in the morning. And I think, you know we have a problem with nitrates in water. We know a proportion of those nitrates are coming from our cereal land. And we know shallow cultivation as a measure has the potential to make a significant contribution to addressing those losses without imposing a massive burden on farmers. And I accept that there is a burden on farmers. You know, and any farmer that doesn't want to do it voluntarily will say, this is an added burden on me. But I suppose, you know, in meeting stakeholders, there were those who said we shouldn't do this now, and said we should cut nitrogen application rates as an alternative to address the situation. And I suppose, you know, in considering that, the first thing we had to be conscious of was, well, you know, cutting nitrogen application rates won't do anything for the nitrogen that's going to be lost out of the soil this autumn and this winter. So that'll only have an impact in the longer term, but that would also have a significant agronomic impact on farmers, we would argue. And, you know, for keen on maintaining that arable land, we have to be conscious of the overall impact a measure will have. So I'm not saying, you know, that at some other point in the future, we may have to look at nitrogen application rates. And as you would know, on the grassland side, there has been a 10% reduction in the maximum chemical nitrogen allowance effective from this year. You know, so that's something that has applied on the grassland side, but the cereal arable side, those rates have been left unchanged for the moment.
And look, tillage has a much higher nitrogen use efficiency level than the grassland side, so hopefully we'll be able to maintain those nitrogen rates from the tillage side. Ted, just another a fairly basic question, but one that people are asking us: can farmers split parcels? So if they have a 10-acre field, can they leave 5 acres of the field in stubble, or can they leave, you know, if they have to cut hedges, can they leave a headland, or, you know, just enough space for the tractor to go around the field?
Yeah, and I suppose that was something we were conscious of in terms of setting a range of values. You know, there's a minimum area and a maximum area to be left in this space for the birds. And if we came out and we said it had to be X percent, the farmer has to be conscious of that and act accordingly, in the same way the department inspector has to be conscious as well. So you're into measuring, and you're into a situation where, you know, you have to know where to stop cultivating. Yeah. In setting the band, you know, the minimum of 20%, the maximum of 25%, our objective was to give farmers that bit of flexibility. So maybe they can shallow cultivate an entire field rather than having to leave a couple of strips uncultivated. Or similarly, they can just eyeball the area and know they're within that band.
So they will be able to, provided they're within that 20-25%, they will be able to split parcels or whatever maybe in order to meet the requirements.
Yeah, split parcels, leave headlands, whatever. Yeah. You know, there's nothing prescriptive about that.
And Ted, you don't need to be notified of that. It's just the farmer, each individual farmer just needs to have his own rough sums done.
Yeah, you know, and like obviously once the sums, when they're done properly, come in between the 20 and the 25%, that farmer is fine. But yeah, the rough sum, the eyeballing of the field, you know, most farmers will know their land well enough to get that right, I'd say.
Yeah. Farmers, Ted, who have complied up to the 29th of July and now I suppose are left in a situation where they don't have that 20 to 25% because maybe the land that was to be left over winter is now cultivated. I presume they're okay. They're not going to face inspection or a penalty if they are inspected.
Yes, they are okay because they were complying with the rules that were in place at the time. So, you know, we have to respect that. And the new requirements in terms of the area to be left aside for the birds, that only applies with effect from the 29th of July onwards.
Does that affect their calculation slightly? So they're only doing their percentages on the area since the winter barley harvest, pretty much?
No, it goes back to the question we had earlier. You know, it's the total cereal area. So I would say look back at the area of cereal land that was declared for BPS earlier in the year, and it's to take the 20 to 25% off that total area. But if a farmer, say, had a lot of winter barley and they've already cultivated all that land, with the result that they've cultivated over 80% of their total area, you know, we recognize they were doing that to comply with the rules at a point in time. So our inspectors will have to be conscious of that.
There would be some people that would probably be on the edge of those numbers because they rely heavily on winter barley as their crop of preference. Can I just do a quick follow-up on that, Ted? And it's following from the question that I had asked you earlier. And this is quite simple, just to say kind of a yes or a no. A person with 80% winter grain, 20% spring grain, winter grain going to be sown in October, does that mean no cultivation is allowed?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
No need to cultivate there. No,
but it's not allowed even because you have to leave the 20% uncultivated.
If you're sowing a catch crop, Andy, you can.
If you're showing a catch crop, you can. Yeah, I'm excluding a catch crop from it, yeah.
Yeah, and to be clear, if they wish, you know, if they want to do shallow cultivation, they still can. The 20 to 25% space for the birds can be left on the land that they're going to sow in October. The same way, you know, it would be left on a farm where 100% of the area is in winter cereals. So, you know, is that clear, or do we need to look at that question again? I know it was meant to be a yes or a no answer.
No, I'm not 100% clear. Like let's put hectares on it very quickly. So start with 100 hectares, 80 hectares going to winter grain to be sown by before October, 20 hectares going to just say spring barley. I know that's an unpractical rotation. It's not a rotation, but just for ease of numbers. So we're saying that the 20 hectares that are left for spring can be left for the birds and therefore don't have to be cultivated. We could put catch crops in them. That's another option. But can I cultivate them and leave nothing for the birds in that scenario?
Yes. You know, the farmer there has three options regarding that spring cereal land. As you say, they can leave it for the birds because it's falling within the 20 to 25% space for the birds. They can put a catch crop into the full area if they wish and still sow all their land in winter cereals as they might wish to do.
Yeah.
And they also have the option to cultivate that land as well if they wish, okay, to do shallow cultivation and leave it to establish a green cover over the winter. Now, in that scenario, they would be relying on the winter cereal land providing what they need to meet this 20 to 25% of cereal land not being subject to shallow cultivation, if you can follow that. So they have a requirement to leave 20 to 25 hectares of land not subject to shallow cultivation, okay? That's based on the 100 hectares total cereal area they have between winter and spring crops. It's up to the farmer to decide where they want to leave that 20 to 25 hectares uncultivated. And that comes back to your point around, you know, the timing of cultivation. If the farmer wishes and, you know, soil's very dry, they could say, look, I want to leave that land in the area that's destined for winter cereals in the autumn. I'll till some of my other winter cereal area because I know it's a good thing to do, but while accepting I don't have an obligation to do it. And because I'm enthusiastic about catch crops or shallow cultivation, I'm going to go in and till all my spring barley land later on in the year, you know?
Okay, so Ted, for somebody like me, basically we read the derogations to the regulation as the proportion of land that is not subject to shallow cultivation rather than leaving land uncultivated.
Yeah, like to be clear, and I'll read from the legislation, it's a minimum of 20% and a maximum of 25% of cereal land on each holding shall not be subject to shallow cultivation post-harvest. If you want to go in and do other work in addition to that shallow cultivation, for example, to sow a crop, that's going beyond that, and that is fine, okay? And the legislation, while it mightn't be as explicit as we might like around that issue, it does recognize it because the next line goes on to say, unless a crop has subsequently been established, that land that's left for the birds shall not be subject to the use of any herbicides until at least February in the following year. So, you know, we're recognizing that a farmer may wish to go in and sow winter barley in that land at the start of October, you know.
And Ted, just that last line that you said, that land subject to the use of herbicides until February, is that land that is, in a sense, has been stubble cultivated, is growing vegetation, if I say it correctly, and is just there for nature. It's what you want to happen. That has to be left there till February. We can't burn it off. That's pretty much, I think, what you're saying. But what about the guy that sowed his winter grain? Is he still, he's not banned from putting on his herbicides, is he?
No, the guy who has sowed the winter grain is fine because he has subsequently established a crop. Okay. Be it winter cereals or catch crops, that is fine. What we're trying to achieve here is, you know, a high quality stubble that will hopefully, you know, where the farmer has decided to leave this area for the birds, it'll hopefully be land that will be retained as stubble over the winter. So it's land that hasn't been subject to shallow cultivation. It will probably have greened up to an extent anyway, as we, you know, traditionally would have seen. but it won't be as green as land that was cultivated. And what we're saying is, you know, we want to try and keep that stubble there over the winter. So rather than the farmer going in, say, in December and spraying it off and maybe plowing it, we're keen to keep that land there as long as possible. Now, if the farmer chooses to plow it, there's no issue. But if the farmer wants to apply a herbicide, we're saying not until at least the 1st of February in the following year.
Ted, that's fairly major. Where is that? Because I haven't seen that rote anywhere. That rule about the glyphosate.
It's in the paragraph there, straight after the minimum of the 20% and the maximum 25% for the birds.
The paragraph on what? Because I'm on the government's page here on the Nitrates Action Programme, and it hasn't been updated since the 14th of March. So where do I find this information? You know, and I'm doing this a lot for my job. You know, if I'm a farmer and my job isn't to research for the Farmers Journal, where do I find any of this information?
It's set out in the new SI. So that's SI 393 of 2022. And now it would be the Department of Housing that are publishing that on their webpage, but I can send you a copy of that, Siobhan, anyway, and you'll see it there. So look, to be clear, this requirement only applies to land that is not subject to shallow cultivation to leave space for the birds. Okay. So, and to situations where a crop has not been established. So it's the traditional stubbles that are just being left over the winter where there is no crop being established. Okay.
So it doesn't apply to the land that has been cultivated and on which the vegetation is growing.
That's correct. Okay. You know, so if you it's separate. It's the land that has not been cultivated.
Yeah. Okay?
So the land that people maybe, you know, they left their stubble uncultivated over the winter for that bird habitat, but they also did that, let's be honest, to get in a bit earlier onto that ground to spread out their workload. So that option is now gone. They can't touch that land until they apply a herbicide to it on the 1st of February, unless it doesn't need that herbicide.
Yeah, I suppose if they feel they need to apply a herbicide, they need to wait till the 1st of February on that land. But it's for the farmer to decide. And I suppose, you know, as we've gone through the case studies, the farmer examples you have, you can see there's a lot of flexibility for farmers to decide where they're going to locate this land, you know.
I hadn't seen that glyphosate comment in the press release, and I don't know where to find it, Ted. And you know, when are farmers actually going to be informed of these rules? Because they haven't been informed officially yet. So you know, how is this all going to play out?
Yeah, and I suppose the first stage in the process is the consultation that we had with stakeholders before the regulations were finalized. Once they were signed by the Minister for Housing, obviously we had a press release for the media. And, you know, we appreciate the media's role in picking up on press releases and then communicating them out to the wider public. But then it's for us to engage with the likes of yourselves, you know, in this podcast, you know, and hopefully obviously the farmers who are listening to this will pick up on the message. But also then we are also doing an FAQ for our website. And our intention is to send an SMS text message to farmers. You know, a lot of farmers will be familiar with this message they can get from DAFM if they've signed up to that service. And we're going to tailor that message to the farmers that have declared cereal land on their BPS this year in the 14 counties where the measure applies. So, you know, rather than communicating with all where it's not relevant, we'll tailor the message down to the smaller group of farmers where it is relevant. And we'll encourage them to click on a link in that message that will hopefully bring them to the FAQ that we will have on our website for farmers.
Okay. And the majority of farmers now are going to be finished the harvest. Some of them are finished already. The majority of them will be finished by Saturday. A lot of them should probably have these jobs completed by the middle of next week if they're to comply. And they haven't been told or made aware. You know, if they don't have a smartphone, they don't listen to the podcast, they don't read media, or they're on their holidays for a week and they miss the paper, they have no clue of these rules. So you know, presumably then this year there won't be penalties or inspections on these. You know, it's a bit late coming out with the rules at the minute.
Yeah, look, I suppose we appreciate it can take time to get the message across to everyone. But, you know, I think anyone who'd read the Farmer's Journal, you know, even if they didn't read any other agricultural media, they should be well au fait with the requirement and the fact that there is space to be left for the birds. Now, the issue then is how that land is to be treated over the winter. And, you know, what we're saying is if you wish, you can go in and you can sow a crop as you normally would at any time. But if you're not doing that, we're saying not to apply glyphosate on that land until at least the 1st of February. And the idea there is to try and keep that stubble land there for as long as possible to provide a high quality stubble for the birds.
Ed, we better wrap up because people only listen to podcasts for so long and we don't want to lose any quality listeners. Can I just ask one quick question before we break? And that is, you know, from an administrator's perspective, how will we know if this is working, when it was worked, when it has worked, etc.? Because if we can't prove that this measure is doing what it's supposed to do for water quality, and we know that it won't happen this year or next year, all of these things are slow by nature when it means watching the water flow through the soil and come back up again. But, you know, what the tillage farmer is worried about is if we can't prove that this is working, will it mean even more harsh measures facing us into the future?
Yeah, it's a fair question, Andy. And I suppose for us, we obviously have to establish the effectiveness of the measures as well. That we can go back to the European Commission and say, look, we have introduced this measure. We know it is working. So through Chagas Agricultural Catchment Program, you know, we have a program of research that is designed to test the effectiveness of measures and to identify new possible measures as well. So, you know, we've six catchments around the country. A number of those catchments will contain land that will be subject to shallow cultivation. So we'll be able to look at that. And then even in some of those fields, we have equipment located within the ground to measure nitrate losses. So we'll gather that data. And yes, it will take time. You know, people talk about, you know, it often being the following year when you see the true impact of a measure around nitrates reduction. So, you know, the work the farmer is doing in the field today will hopefully contribute to establishing a green cover that will grow through the autumn and the winter to take up nitrogen that will otherwise be leached down through the soil. And, you know, we'd expect to see that really coming through in next year's water quality data. We won't probably see it much before that, but, you know, we should see it in the 2023 water quality data. We do have an interim review of the Nitrates Action Program that is scheduled to take place in 2023. And that will lead to possible adjustments to the program from 2024 onwards. But the program itself then is due to run to the end of 2025. That's when we have the next main review of the overall program. So I suppose by then we will have a good bit of data around this measure. We'll also hopefully have a lot of data around the impact on farmland bird populations as well. And, you know, at that stage, it's when we'll be looking at all possible solutions and the trends. And look, if we can address these issues and, you know, reduce our losses to water, we'll all be in a better place when it comes to that review in 2025.
You're here to that.
Okay, I think we've quizzed you enough, Ted. So thanks very much for coming on. And look, we'll be in touch with more queries as they come up, I think.
Okay, look, thanks very much, guys. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
So that was Andy and myself talking to Ted earlier on. And look, as we get more updates on nitrates and those rules, and as we continue to clarify them, we'll, of course, update readers and listeners on those regulations. We'll move on to grain markets, Andy. Quiet enough this week.
Yes, in relative terms, quiet enough this week, Siobhan. We've seen prices kind of hovering around the 325, I suppose is better to say, 325, 326 euro on the futures markets. Losing a little bit some days, picking up another little bit more days. Today, as we talk, it's up about 175. Last trade, 326.50. But I think, you know, if we look at the market overall now, where futures are is an indication of thinking, but it's not where prices are that influence what we are going to get as growers. In that market now, the price of imported maize is a far more dominant feature of what's influencing price, in particular influencing barley price, because the trade know and realise that for barley to be widely used in rations, it has to compete pretty closely or even be somewhat under maize to find its way into rations to use it all up. So that's very much part of what's going on. And in that regard, the physical prices, they really haven't changed in the last 3 or 4 weeks. Now, when I say they haven't changed, they were operating within a band of volatility that's kind of running between 345 and 350 for wheat. And depending on the day, you know, you might get offers that equate to that. Occasionally, I see actual physical prices that will exceed that from an individual merchants who are trying to get their hands on a certain quantity of material. But in the main, it's floating around in respect of those general trade numbers. Barley still also about 15 under, but the 15 under is somewhat more of a movable feast because it's, as well as being discounted against wheat, it's also been forced to be competitive with maize, so a little bit more variability in barley in the market. So that's it, Siobhan. There's no kind of major changes there. It's interesting to see some of the merchants out already with prices for next year to try and entice guys in. And I was quite surprised this morning and delighted, I suppose, to see a forward price for green rape for next year, I think 385, if I'm remembering correctly, from Dairy Gold, certainly there or thereabouts. And it's in a sense, it's a statement of intent as to where people are being driven and to in a sense to follow the margin, follow the price. And that's really what life should be about. Go where the margin is going to take us. Yeah. So I'm just taking a quick look. Green harvest, 275 for barley for next. No, sorry, that's great. 233 for green barley for next harvest from Dairy Gold, and 242 for wheat. So, you know, there's prices there for people who want to ask. They will, of course, move with depending on the day, and they're being heavily influenced by futures prices. But I was pretty much right. The green harvest price for rape for 2023 was 584. Like, that's an attractive price because this time last year, we'd have been kind of very happy to be looking at 450 in that slot. And we know how well the crop has done. It's probably had its single biggest record yield in Ireland this year. And it's definitely going to yield on average over 2 tonne. Individual yields up as far as 2.5, 2.6. We've never heard of those in Ireland before.
Yeah. And that 584 price, you know, when we have the weather that we have and harvest is going to be fairly wrapped up for most people in the next few weeks to plant rape. So look, it looks like a really good option for people.
Yeah, I might be a small bit shy about planting it in the real dry conditions unless you had done a good job on your seed bed. But look, the ground is very warm, and if you planted it a week later than normal, it'll probably make up that week very, very quickly when a drop of rain comes and she gets going.
Yeah, but great to be able to do it when there's no harvesting going on as well. Andy, speaking of sowing conditions, what's the weather saying?
Well, Sean, I'm guessing that most people are kind of conscious of what the weather forecast is for the next while. Yeah. We're hearing it almost daily and everybody is talking about the weather. But I think that if the forecast that we have holds true, it would be easy to be lulled into a false sense of insecurity. Because the forecast in the journal this week from Met Éireann is certainly talking about rain from Sunday onwards. But they're talking predominantly about heavy thunder showers. So you might see no rain and you might see a whole deluge of rain falling on you. The deluge would be terrific if they're looking at stubbles with straw baled. The deluge would be horrific if you still have crops standing and they're already ripe, because there's a danger that they would cause some damage. But kind of all zeros up to Sunday. Then on Sunday, kind of the west and northwest set for the biggest amount of rain. But after that, the southwest and west looking at kind of 13s and 12s and 13s again in terms of daily rainfall, kind of running at 0.5 inches per day. Again, you could miss it or you could get it, but you could easily see 1, 2, or 3 inches of rain over the next over the early days of next week if you were unlucky or lucky, depending on your point of view. Other parts of the country then, particularly along the east coast and southeast, likely to remain much, much drier than that, with largely dry days all the way through. So where the bulk of the grain is, where a lot of the harvesting will be finished, probably or hopefully, weather is likely to be much more kind than for the people who have a lot more cutting to do, who are just barely starting. Yeah. And that's most unfortunate. Temperatures, of course, we all know the story on temperatures because it's all over the place at this point in time. You know, temperatures to increase pretty much up to Sunday with the likelihood of very high 20s, if not into 30s in parts of the country by then, and probably more likely to be the hottest in the south, according to MedEarn. But you know, warm everywhere and by all standards. Interesting to see the wind whipping around to the east and the northeast and still temperatures staying up pretty high. But I guess that's just a feature of the time of year. Temperatures at night, of course, staying up as well. Whether that results in dew or fog remains to be seen, but there's probably quite a risk of that happening, which could shorten the working day to some degree if anybody is really on hell for leather at it.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much the weather as I see it, Siobhan.
Thanks very much, Andy. And thanks to you for listening. I know, look, the show was a bit longer than normal, but I think that nitrates information was very valuable, and we'll continue to update you on that. So, look, as harvest progresses, look, stay safe and get the work done. But, you know, I know the moisture's dropping, but take your time and keep safe above all things, and keep the tillage flag flying.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.